Welcome, everyone. So it's a great pleasure to have David Radice to give the Strong Gravity seminar this week. And David, I guess, we'll talk about multi-messenger astrophysics with neutron stars. David, please take it away.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me giving the seminar. It's a real pleasure to virtually visit Perimeter. Today, I will tell you a little bit about things we can do with multi-messenger astrophysics in the context of neutron star mergers, or what we can learn. So let me start with two very general questions that at first sight, they have nothing to do with neutron star mergers, but obviously they are connected to neutron star mergers. So these are, what is the nature of matter at extreme densities? What would happen if I were to take this lemon and squeeze it really down to the size of an atomic nucleus? And the second question is, where are elements heavier than iron? For example, the gold in your ring, where does it come from? Was it produced in a supernova? Was it produced in a neutron star merger? We don't know. So I'm going to talk about these two questions. So let me start with the first one. So if we want to investigate the nature of matter at really extreme densities, one way to do this is using heavy ion colliders, like Rick at Brookhaven National Lab. So what these colliders do, they accelerate heavy nuclei, for example, gold nuclei, to velocities close to the speed of light, and then they smash them together. And in the collision, they create matter that has extreme densities and temperature, as illustrated by these simulations here. So here you can see the two nuclei that are relativistically contracted, essentially two thin sheets, colliding as they collide. The nucleons, neutrons, and protons in these nuclei are melted into a soup of quark and gluons that we call quark-gluon plasma. This plasma expands for a little bit before cooling down and condensing in a shower of particles. This is eventually observable in these experiments. This is a summary of what we have learned from these experiments. This is the phase diagram of QCD. So we have temperature on the y-axis and the proxy for density on the x-axis, the baryon chemical potential. We live down here at very low temperature and densities. And these nuclear experiments probe this phase of the diagram. So at temperatures in excess of 150 MeV and higher, and close to vacuum density, because in these collisions, due to the high energy of the collision, there is almost an equal number of particles and antiparticles. So effectively, we are probing zero densities. If you're not used to think about temperature in MeV, you can think that one MeV is about 10 to the 10 Kelvin. So these are really extreme temperatures. So what we have learned is that at these really high temperatures, the ordinary nucleons melt into quark-gluon plasma. And as this material cools down, then it recombines back into the hadron gas. So there is really a phase transition, like the transition of water into vapor that happens in these conditions. What happens in this corner of the phase diagram is much less understood because we don't have direct experimental evidences. Some people think that there may be a critical point after which the phase transition changes character. And instead of being a crossover phase transition, it becomes a first order phase transition. But this is something that we don't know. The experiments here on Earth cannot probe this region. Neutron stars instead live in this corner of parameter space that, that we cannot recreate here on Earth. So they have relatively low temperatures and extreme densities. And neutron star mergers probe all of this region of the diagram that is complementary to terrestrial experiments. So by looking at neutron stars, we hope to learn about the phase diagram of dense matter. This is my one slide introduction on neutron stars. So neutron stars pack masses, a mass of material that is larger than the mass of our sun, perhaps up to three solar masses. We don't know precisely what the maximum mass is, in a radius of only of the order of 10 to 15 kilometers. What we know about neutron stars from solving the equations of relativistic stellar structure is that their central density exceeds nuclear density by factors of several. And so this is the conditions in which matter may change phase, for example. So we don't know really what happens inside neutron stars. So the hope is that by observing neutron stars in the sky, we can learn about this matter in this question mark region inside the stars. obviously we cannot go there and chop a neutron star into pieces like this to see what is inside. So we have to do something a little bit more indirect. So let me make the problem statement a little bit more precise. So what we have from theory, from nuclear theories, we have predictions for how the pressure inside the neutron star should vary as a function of the energy density. For example, I may construct a theory in which I assume that nucleons, neutrons and protons, are stable all the way to, I don't know, 10 times nuclear density. And this theory will predict a pressure density curve. Now, by solving the equation of stellar structure, we can map this pressure density curve into a mass radius curve. So for each neutron star mass, we can predict its radius, or the other way around. And so the idea is that by observing neutron star and measuring their masses and radii, we can then invert this relation between the pressure and density and the mass radius diagram to constrain the equation of state, so to constrain directly this space, this side of the plot. This way we can maybe rule out some of these nuclear theories that predict the pressure versus density relations that are inconsistent with our observations. There are different ways to go about doing this. There are, for example, a very successful approach has been to use X-ray measurements of neutron stars as a way to say something about their masses and radii. But today we'll focus on bineutron star mergers, because neutron star mergers are essentially nature Large Hadron Collider. This is where two neutron stars in spiral due to the emission of gravitational wave before eventually coming into contact and merging. And the hope is that by looking at signatures of these systems, we can probe the interior structure of neutron stars the same way as when we probe the interior structure of nucleons in relatively heavy ion collisions. So in order to predict what happens in these collisions, we have to perform numerical relativity simulations. And so today I will present you a result obtained with this code called WhiskyTHG. I will show just a brief advertisement. This code is completely open source and publicly available. So if you're curious about things that I'm showing, you're very welcome to go to this web page and download it. And it comes with really everything you need to reproduce or falsify everything I say. We also make publicly available not just the code, but our initial data, equation of state tables, and even the input files. So the only thing that you will need to provide is your own supercomputing center, which we cannot provide to you. But everything else is available. Just to give an example of one of my simulations, I want to show you this rendering of density. This color here is density in a neutron star binary system. At the bottom, I'm also showing an elevation plot for the Laplace function. If you don't know what this is, you can think of this as being a proxy for the gravitational potential of the stars. Otherwise, if you are an expert in numerical relativity, you will know that this is the Laplace function, what it is. So we start all of our simulations just a few orbits prior to merger. Because this is really the most nonlinear phase of the dynamics where we need numerical relativity. So you can see the stars spiraling as they meet gravitational waves. They come together and emerge to form this object that survives for a little bit of time before collapsing into black hole. And the end state of the simulation, at least in this case, is a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk. I'm not sure how well this movie played through Zoom, so let me recall a couple of frames showing key highlights. The first is as the stars approach each other, they deform due to their mutual tidal interaction. And by looking at tidal deformations, this is one way in which we can probe the equation of state of neutron stars, as I will discuss in a moment. The second thing we saw is that as the stars collide, neutron star material is ejected into space. We think that this material will radioactively decay to power an electromagnetic transient that we call kilonova. And so this ejection material is very consequential for the electromagnetic counterparts to bineutron star mergers. And finally, the final state is a compact object. It could be a massive neutron star, depending on the equation of state and the initial masses of the stars in the binary, or a black hole, but in general, a compact object with some accretion disk. is the end state of all of our simulations. This accretion disk is then expected to evolve over time scales of order of a few seconds that at the moment we cannot yet simulate in full numerical relativity. But other groups can perform simulations either in Newtonian gravity or with fixed space time, so or with other approximations. We think that neutron star mergers are not shy about advertising their collisions. And the theorists have dreamed of a lot of possible ways to observe neutron star mergers, not just through gravitational waves in a spiral merger, post-merger, but through electromagnetic radiation, either due to thermal processes like the kilonova, or due to completely non-thermal processes like the gamma ray burst jet and the afterglow. And all of this is nicely summarized in this paper, this review paper by Fernandez and Metzger from 2016. I really like this paper because it came out about a year before the first detection actually occurred. So at this stage, when this paper was written, we had yet no observations at all of these systems. Then, of course, the year after, we saw GW1708-17, the first binary-neutron star merger to be observed with gravitational waves and light. And we detected almost everything that was predicted in the theory. Not everything yet, but almost everything. And this is a slide summarizing some of the things that have been detected. I'm sure that you have seen many other talks on this event, so I will not go into all of the details. What I want to emphasize is that gravitational waves were really the star of the show, because thanks to gravitational waves, we can say that this was a double neutron star system and not something completely different, like a core collapse supernova, for example. We know this because we have the gravitational wave signal, and we can compare it with analytic theoretical templates of the waveform. For example, this is a comparison with the tidal EOB model. And we see that there is a perfect matching between what we expected in theory and what we saw observationally. And by looking at the best matching theory template, essentially, we can also measure the parameters of the binary. More in detail, the way this works is that if we have the gravitational wave signal, for example, as a function of frequency, it will have an amplitude that depends on things like the sky position, the inclination of the source, the antenna pattern of the detector, so things that are of interest for our observers, colleagues, and has a phase. And the phase itself is the most interesting part for us because it's the phase, the part that LIGO measures the best, and it's also the part that encodes all of the physics of these binaries. So the phase itself can be expanded. In post-Newtonian theory, the leading orders have this form. So there is a leading order term that depends on the chirp mass. So this is the quantity we can measure with the highest precision because it enters a leading order. And then there are corrections that depend on other things like the mass ratio, the spin, and tidal information. And by essentially looking at the phase as a function of frequency, we can measure these parameters. So the simple-minded way to do this would be essentially a fit of a power law. In practice, this is done using more sophisticated Bayesian parameter estimation methods. And this is the these are the data for GW1708-17, and you can see that indeed we measure very well this particular combination of M1 and M2 that is given by the chirp mass. We measure less well the individual masses of the stars. Using the gravitational wave signal, different authors, starting from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, have tried to estimate the tidal deformability of the stars and to relate this tidal deformability to the radius of either the two stars, R1 and R2, or the radius of reference 1.4 solar mass neutron star. This paper summarizes some of the most recent reanalysis that has been done of this data using the latest effective one-body model. And you can see here the posterior using two slightly different ways to treat the data. I can go more, in more detail if there is interest, but essentially these two red and black line correspond to our theoretical uncertainty at the moment. And we can see that we can already constrain the tidal deformability. We have a very strong constraint that tidal deformability is not larger than about 800. It's a little bit more debatable whether we can really rule out that the deformability is zero. And this translates into a constraint of the neutron star radius to be between about 10 and 14 kilometers. And again, there are differences due to theoretical uncertainties, but at the moment we are not too worried because the system, the statistical uncertainties arising from the detector noise are larger than these error bars here. But pretty soon, if we don't improve our theory, we'll be in trouble. But this is not really what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about multi-messenger astrophysics. So where is the multi-messenger coming in? So in order to explain this, let me go back one step and explain how this Bayesian data analysis work. So suppose that we have a signal, this data, and we want to measure some parameters associated with the source. This theta array could be a vector of parameters. So we want to measure the confidence that we have that these parameters lay in some range. So we express this as a posterior probability distribution. Bayes' theorem tells us that this should be proportional to the prior and to the likelihood. So how likely is that we see a signal with this data given these parameters. So with multi-messenger parameter estimation, what we do is we split this into two parts. One part that depends only on the gravitational wave data, and one part that depends on the electromagnetic data. So here we're assuming these two data to be independent data. With this assumption, we can factorize the likelihood like this. So how to model this part? This is the content of gravitational wave data analysis theory. And I think you have there at perimeter people that are much more experienced than me to discuss this part, so I will not go very much into this. I want to comment a little bit on how we can model this part. So what we have done is we have developed a semi-analytic model for the kilonova light core, so the quasi-thermal counterpart of binary star mergers. So what this does is it predicts the light curve and the color of the kilonova given the properties of the ejecta. So assuming that we know the property of the material ejected from these mergers, we can produce the light curve. So by combining this data with this model, we can estimate what were the masses and the composition of the outflows, for example. Then we have numerical relativity simulation that predict the input of this model, so the ejecta properties, as a function of fundamental parameters of the binary, for example, the mass ratio and the tidal deformability. So we put these two things together, and now we have the likelihood expressed in the same parameters theta that enter both gravitational wave data analysis and now also the electromagnetic pipeline. So with this, we can, for example, place joint constraints on the tidal deformability. This is something we have done in a couple of works, and not just us, but a number of groups worldwide have started similar efforts. And this plot collects together results from many different groups. So you can see that all of us, we're all converging to a statement that says that the neutron star radius is between 11 and 13 kilometers, looking at the 1.4 solar mass neutron star. With different level of confidence. So these three colored ones are our own estimates. In doing this, what we do, we also have parameters that we use to calibrate these numerical relativity fits and model their uncertainty. So we propagate our estimates for systematic uncertainties through our pipeline. And so this is how we compute these error bars. So I can say that the physics that goes into this fit is actually pretty well understood. And so we're pretty confident that these results are robust. What we need to improve is in the systematic errors. In principle, we could reduce this error bar significantly if we had better numerical relativity simulations or a better coverage of parameter space. So that is this is quite promising. And essentially,
Davide, do you mind if I interrupt?
Yeah, no, not at all.
So I have a question about this plot. So do you have a sense of what would happen if you were to get rid of, you know, gravitational wave data or get rid of electromagnetic data? So, you know, what would happen to that plot if you only had one source of information?
Yes. So the gravitational wave data is mostly constraining from this side. So gravitational wave very confidently rules out very large neutron star radii, because large neutron star radii will give you very large tidal deformability. So that would be easy to detect. While electromagnetic data pushes the constraint from this direction. Very small neutron star radii in our simulation always produce remnants that survive for a short amount of time before collapsing to black hole, because the stars are very compact. And so there is not enough material left outside of the event horizon of the black hole to explain current electromagnetic observations. So to leading order, this is how this constraint looks like.
Okay, nice. Thank you.
So where we are in terms of constraining the equation of state, this is a figure that I took from Latimer 2012 that has a number of...
may I just ask a question there
Go ahead.
So you mentioned about this modeling uncertainty. Are you referring to the just the modeling uncertainty of the numerical simulations? So these supernovae models, how confident are we about these models?
So there are two types of uncertainty. There is an uncertainty in the results of each numerical simulation, which we estimate to be, for example, of the order of 50% in the ejecta mass and the final disk mass. But the real systematic uncertainty comes from these feeds. So if you look here, these are different data points. And this is, for example, the ejecta mass is a function of mass ratio and tidal deformability. So the feed that we are using is this colored contours here. But if you see the different simulations, you will see that this feed doesn't capture everything that's happening in this simulation cell. So the ejecta is not uniquely determined by mass ratio and tidal deformability. There are other things that have to do with the equation of state details that are not included in these feeds. So what we do is not only we have the feed, but we have additional parameters that describe deviation from the feed, and we marginalize over those parameters. And we choose those parameters to encompass all possible, so the prior on those parameters to encompass all possible deviations that we see from this feed. So at the moment, this is the leading source of error. If we don't include this, and we just include the numerical simulation error, the error bars become invisible. So basically, you get just the data point. Of course, that would be a wrong result because we don't believe in these feeds to that level. But if you were to blindly trust the feeds, you'll get almost no error. And the measurement, the error actually is a few hundred meters, if I remember right. So plus or minus about 100 meter. If we had perfect theoretical models, which we don't have.
Okay, thank you.
So this is quite promising. In terms of constraining the equation of state, this is kind of where we are at the moment. And this is a bit of a cartoon because really we're only constraining the radius around 1.4 solar masses. And there are other constraints that come from other observations too that one would need to add. But essentially, after this one event, we can already rule out very stiff equations of state or very soft equations of state that produce very small neutron star radii. Now, what about the goals? So I promised to talk about two questions. One was the equation of state, and one was the production of heavy elements. So the best evidence we have today that neutron star mergers produce heavy elements come from this set of observations here. This is the light curve following 170817. In different bands, so from the UV in blue to the infrared here in red. So what we see from this data is that in order to explain it, we have to invoke two different components in the outflow that are sometimes called blue and red Kironova. And depending on which models you use for the outflow, these numbers that are shown here may vary by up to a factor of a few, so don't take these numbers too seriously. But all models require two components. One component of material that had relatively low opacity and large expansion velocity. This material had to radiate most of its energy at early times in order to explain the early time UV optical data. And another component had to be very optically thick to trap radiation until late time and let radiation escape only later in the infrared. So this material had to expand, cool down, and then you get black body emission in the right wavelength. And the expansion velocity for this material was also somewhat lower. So we think that in order to explain especially this red component, this high opacity, we need to invoke the production of heavy elements, because only heavy elements, especially lanthanides, have the complex atomic structure required to explain these very large opacities. And nuclear physics suggests that once you form lanthanides, you're also very likely to form gold, but we don't have direct evidence that we have formed gold. We have very strong evidence that we have formed lanthanides, and it's quite unlikely to form one and not the other, but this is the best evidence. So how does this compare with our simulations? So recently we published a study where we took the Chern mass from 17OS17 and explored different equations of state and different mass ratios to see what kind of results we get in numerical relativity. So these diamonds here that you see in this plot are the mass and the average electron fraction of the dynamical ejecta from neutron star merger. In order to explain the blue Kirnova, we have to be roughly in this blue square here. And in order to explain the red component of the Kirnova, we will need to be in this corner of parameter space here. So what you can see immediately is that numerical relativity simulations cannot explain by themselves anything, because the dynamic ejecta, so material ejecta in the first 20 milliseconds or so, is not massive enough to explain the red Kirnova. It's either too proton rich or too little proton rich to explain the blue Kirnova, and the velocity is also wrong, although this is not what I'm showing. So the dynamic ejecta may have contributed to the emission, but was for sure not the main contributor. So how do we explain then observations? There are a few proposals out. One proposal that we have put out is that the way to explain this blue Kirnova is with a spiral wave wind. So what we find in our simulations is that if the remnant does not collapse to black hole immediately, material is ejected through hydrodynamic processes in the accretion disk with the right properties to explain this blue Kirnova. So, and this seems to be a very robust mechanism. It doesn't require us to invoke magnetic fields or other physics that is not understood at the moment. The red Kirnova is a little bit more of a problem to explain. We cannot explain it with our simulations, but there are good reasons to believe that what happens to the remnant accretion disk on timescales much longer than what we can simulate now can produce this red Kirnova. And there are simulations like, for example, those by Daniel Siegel that seem to point out that this happens. But we don't have at the moment any fully self-consistent model starting from inspiral merger and post-merger that can really explain this observation. So let me show you what I mean by the spiral wave wind. I have here another simulation like the one we saw at the beginning. Now the two stars have a slight mass asymmetry. So you can see that one will deform more and almost ideally disrupt before merger. And now we form this hypermassive neutron star. And what we can see is that the neutron star is deformed. And as the neutron star rotates, it's also launching waves in the accretion disk. And these waves are what we think cause mass ejections in these systems. So in particular, we have computed the angular momentum carried by these waves, and we see that these waves are carrying positive angular momentum out. So they're extracting angular momentum from the hypermassive neutron star, they're depositing it in the disk and triggering a mass outflow. We see that this mass outflow persists as long as the neutron star doesn't collapse to black hole. And this is an example of one simulation in red that had a very long-lived neutron star. And you can see an almost constant mass ejection rate as a function of time after merger. We see that looking again at this red histogram that this ejecta has the right velocity around 0.2c. and to explain the blue kernel. It also had a sufficiently high proton fraction, this red histogram, to escape the production of heavy, very heavy elements. And so it could reasonably explain the blue kernel. This seems to be robust. We see it in all simulations. It only terminates when the black hole forms. Like in this Latimer Schwarz, this LS220 blue simulation had black hole formation occurring here. And you can see that mass ejection plateaus. At this point, it stops. So if we were to take this model that we have evolved for now, I think almost 100 milliseconds post-merge, and assume that mass ejection were to continue for until 150 or 200 milliseconds, then we'll have enough mass to explain the blue kernova. And we can actually do this explicitly. So we have taken the data from our simulations and estimated the light course in different bands. So from the green band to infrared. I should look again at the red line, this is the binary that did not collapse the black hole. And we see that we can explain nicely the optical data, even at early times, as claimed, and some of the red data. We still struggle to explain the infrared excess. So in order to explain the infrared excess, we'll need to invoke some other mechanism here producing additional mass ejection at later times. So this is still something completely to be solved. We have also looked at the nucleosynthesis in both dynamical eject and the wind together. And we find that interestingly enough, we form our process with relative abundances comparable to solar abundances. So here are the gray dots are the solar abundances of our process elements. These are the prediction from our simulations. So this seems to be a consistent picture. Of course, I should mention that there are other alternatives that have been proposed to explain the blue kernova. For example, a way to explain it would be through a magnetized wind from the massive neutron star left behind. The difference is that our proposal works out of the box in ab initio simulation. It doesn't require us to invoke anything, any magnetic fields, while all other proposals so far have been proposed, but not really verified in ab initio simulations. And I was already mentioning the fact that we're struggling to explain the infrared data, but perhaps the work by Daniel Siegel can come to help us, because what they showed is that after the black hole has formed, mass ejection doesn't really stop. Mass ejection will continue due to magnetic processes. And eventually, at some point, the disk will evaporate completely due to the formation of alpha particles. So the recombination of nucleons in this disk into nuclei liberates enough energy to unbind a significant fraction of the disk. And according to their simulation, this will have the right properties to explain the red kernova. Okay, in the last few minutes, I want to talk a little bit about exciting things that we can do in the future. So things that we haven't seen already using the post-merge gravitation wave signal. For 1708-17, we saw the gravitation wave in the Inspira, so we were able to constrain the tidal deformability, but we essentially lost any signal to noise ratio after gravitation wave frequency of about a kilohertz. So we didn't see the high frequency component of the signal. This is because the noise in LIGO grows rapidly with frequency past a few hundred hertz, where the maximum sensitivity is. On the other hand, the theory predicts that if the neutron star merger doesn't produce a black hole promptly, a massive neutron star will form that will be a very efficient emitter of gravitational waves. And what many studies have shown is that if we take the post-merger gravitational wave and we make a Fourier transform, then we discover that this signal has some characteristic frequencies, this F2 minus zeros, F spiral feature. And the most prominent feature is what we call F peak or F2, depending on which papers you read, which is a frequency at which most of the signal is emitted. So it's a characteristic peak frequency in the post-merger. And so the hope is that by looking at a post-merge signal and measuring this peak frequency, we could in principle learn something about the question of state at even higher densities than those reached in the Inspire, because after all, after the stars collided, their density increases by maybe a factor of 1.5 or 2. And their temperature also increases from essentially zero temperature to maybe 50 to 100 MeV. There are many ideas in the literature for what we can learn about FPIC, and I want to present just one. But before I do that, yes, one of the things I wanted to mention is that the post-merge is also a way to probe this high-density physics. For example, recently we have looked at the possibility of the confined phase transition by comparing equations of state that have the confined quarks appearing at high density versus equations of state that are entirely hadronic. And what we find is that this is imprinted primarily in the lifetime of the remnants. When a quark forms, essentially they remove the degeneracy pressure from the from the neutrons. And this reduces in a loss of pressure support. So the remnant becomes more compact and collapses more rapidly. And there are many other works that have been also published recently on this. So this is what we can do, for example, if we can measure the peak frequency. So this is a study that was led by Matteo Breschi, a student in Jena, working with us. So what he noticed is that if we take this peak frequency F2, we can construct an effective radius of the remnant. This is just a reparametrization, if you want, of F2. Now, if we compare this radius that we are dimensionalizing this way with the solar mass and speed of light, the mass of the system, gravitational constant, the speed of light, and we compare this to the maximum density that can be achieved in a non-rotating neutron star, we find a universal relation. So this means that different binaries will be in different points on this line, for example, and different equations of state will also predict different points. But all of these points align. They are all on this line. So if we're able to measure this quantity here, we can read off what the maximum density of a neutron star should be. And we have done an injection study where we have injected the simulated signal and into noise and recover them, assuming a detection with the Einstein telescope, a proposed third generation detector that will maybe start taking data sometimes in the 2030s in Europe. We have assumed a signal to noise ratio of 7. So this is the minimum signal to noise ratio you need to claim a detection. So what you can see here in gray, I lost my mouse pointer. Okay, here it is. In gray, you see the current set of all equations of state currently not ruled out. We injected this equation of state in black, so we assume this to be natural equation of state. And now we do the analysis to check in what way we can constrain the equation of state. If we don't look at the post-merger just by measuring the tidal deformability, we can constrain very precisely the equation of state at mass close to the mass of the two stars that have merged in this case. So this will give us the red shaded area here. However, if we add on top of this measurement, the measurement of FPIC, we can see that we can constrain the equation of state to much higher densities. And we essentially recover the injected equation of state. So this is a very promising way to constrain the equation of state extreme densities. So some of the challenges for the future. I have said a few things about the nice things we can do with the post-merger signal. There are still a lot of things that we need to better understand in order to make best use of future observations or even to completely understand the existing observations. And one challenge is that there are possibly systematic uncertainties in this, especially the post-merger simulations. We need to be able to perform long-term GRMHT simulations that extend much further in time. At the moment, for example, when we are explaining the Kironova, we are doing this in a piecewise fashion. So we have simulations that probe the dynamical phase of the merger. Somebody else takes a disk model in equilibrium around the black hole with parameters that may or may not resemble what we get in our simulations. And by piecing this story together, we can say that we can explain current observations. But of course, if we want to really make use of the data, we should have models that explain everything, starting from the output of the gravitational wave data analysis. So a challenge is that we need to be able to run for maybe 10 times longer than we can now. We worry about MHC turbulence effect that will become important over these time scales. And that will require our resolution also to increase by a factor of 10. And over this time scale, we also have to worry about neutrino radiation effects that we are currently only approximating in our simulation. So there are a lot of challenges ahead of us, so a lot of work to be done. So I've already come to the conclusions. I hope that the take-home message from this talk that you got from this talk is that numerical relativity can play a very important role in the interpretation of multi-messenger signals from compact binaries. And that we can already do multi-messenger astronomy today. We don't have to wait for the perfect simulation. If we're careful and we propagate our uncertainties in our models in a correct way, we can already learn something using multi-messenger observation that we cannot learn just by looking at the gravitational wave data alone. We're also learning a lot about the origin of our process elements in this way. I have showed you some ab initio models of 17OS17, where we took essentially the output of gravitation wave detector and ran large grids of simulations to compare then gravitation wave and electromagnetic data to our theory models. And this has been quite successful. We have recently published the follow-up study also for 19.04.25, for which we have the gravitational wave signal, but we did not detect the electromagnetic counterpart. And we are learning a lot in this process, and we will learn even more with future observations. And so the main message is that there is a bright future ahead of us in multi-messenger astronomy. Thank you.
Thank you for the nice talk. Any questions, additional questions? Maybe I can start with one question. So you talk about this post-merger simulation, and then you said by adding this post-merger measurement, you can better constrain the equation state, especially at high densities. But as far as I know, there are huge uncertainties in these simulations. What kind of, like, are you using some kind of peak mode to infer the equation state, or are you using a full post-merger waveform? So what?
So here we are. We're assuming that we can measure F peak, and also in this. So we have Matteo Breschi has developed a post-merger waveform model that is in part phenomenological. So the post-merger waveform is described using a combination of wavelets and parameters, so we can do numerical relativity injections. We have the simulation. We can do the recovery using this model, and so we can estimate with which precision we can recover some features in the data. And one feature that we can recover quite well is the F2, which is also something that is very robust in simulation. So we can we are quite confident in F2 because, for example, if we try to perturb our simulation by adding viscosity or changing resolution or comparing different codes, we find that F2 is a robust feature between all of the different simulations, while other features in the spectrum are a little bit less clear. And also for this, we have calibration parameters that have been propagated through the pipeline. So I think we can estimate also our uncertainty. So if we don't assume errors in the theory, then we can recover the equation state even better, but probably that would be an overstatement. I don't know if this answers your question.
Yeah, okay. I think Reed has a question.
Yeah, thanks for the nice talk. Picking up on the point that you just made about the uncertainties of scattering the model in, for example, the inter-risk relation. Could you perhaps comment on what your perception is of the understanding of how implicit assumptions in which EOSs are used in our simulations, how that would propagate. So for example, in your fit of the ejecta mass, so the function of Q and lambda tilde, those in our simulations only used a handful of EOSs, right? Which are due to the availability of like full temperature EOSs, like the phenomenology is relatively limited there. So do you think perhaps that those fits, even with the errors that you're estimating, could be an underrepresentation of the scatter of what the true uncertainty in the EOS is?
Yeah, this is a very good question. I think there are many parts to this answer, and there are many things that are connected. So there are some things that we understand better. For example, universal relations used to break degeneracies between lambda 1 and lambda 2 in gravitational wave data analysis. That part we understand well, where the systematics are, and there are possibly ways around it. On the multi-messenger side, when we look at models of the ejecta, we understand things much less because we have fewer equations of state, fewer simulations, and so there is a concern that there may be larger systematic uncertainty than what we estimated. This is a fair concern. So we have run the largest set of simulations today with a large number of equations of state, but obviously we have not run everything. And so as time progresses, we'll have to revise these feats and revise our estimates for sure.
Okay, thanks. Just one more comment. Even with the universal relations, if you base those on relatively smooth equations of state without large phase transitions and stuff like that, you'll get, for example, one amount of like a particular amount of scatter between lambda and R, right? Because if you want to quote things in R as opposed to lambda tilde, which actually affects your waveform, some people use that mapping. But if you give up on the assumption that the EOS has to be some sort of very smooth function, then you actually can get about twice the scatter.
Yes. Yeah, this is a very good comment. One thing I want to show from our old work, this is what we have checked here. So here we have recalibrated universal relation using a set of 2 million equations of state phenomenological. And we have compared the posteriors we get in lambda to idola using our recalibrated fits and the original universal relation from Younes and Yagi. And you see that there are differences. And these differences are translated in radius. They are a few hundred meters. So it's something that maybe we don't worry too much about right now. But if you think about third generation detectors, this is way larger than the target precision of Cosmic Explorer. So for sure, there is something problematic with universal relations that need to be addressed if we want to use universal relations at all.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Aman?
Hi, thank you, David, for the nice talk. I had a question about the spiral wave model, which you used to explain the blue component of the kilonova. Sure. You might have mentioned this, but that depended on the lifetime of the remnant, right? Which in turn depends on the EOS. So is there, like, have you done this like an inversion problem from data? If you use this model as a fiducial model, how do you, can you draw any constraints on the lifetime of the remnant and then on the EOS itself? And how do those constraints compare with the other constraints?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So what I can say is that we have not done it. I can tell you that if you assume that the remnant lifetime was about 200 milliseconds, this model seemed to give the right numbers. I'm not sure that I would necessarily trust such analysis because we are essentially extrapolating past the end of our simulation. So this may be something a little bit dangerous to do. But yes, in principle, this suggests a lifetime of around 200 milliseconds. And yeah, I'm not sure how to translate that to equation of state.
Okay, thank you.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank the reader again.